Before listening to the word of exhortation, we're going to sing hymn 189. Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to Thee. Take my moments and my days, let them flow in ceaseless praise. Take my hands and let them move at the impulse of Thy love. Take my feet and let them be swift and beautiful for Thee. Hymn 189. Please give your careful attention to our brother as he reads from God's Word. Brethren and sisters, this exhortation has been prepared for us this morning by Brother Nathan Toms, who unfortunately is not able to be here. Among the many abilities that we have been blessed with, the ability to predict the future is notably absent. In spite of this, I think that it's probably true that every one of us spends a large amount of our time in picturing the future in our minds. Something we have to do on a day-to-day basis. We probably refer to this as short-term planning, and it is a very normal and necessary part of life. We very rarely go through life completely aimlessly.
Instead, we create pictures in our minds of what we expect to happen and plan our immediate futures accordingly. When these pictures refer to what we would like to happen beyond the immediate future, we call them ambitions or aspirations. And I'd like to think about this for a few minutes before we take the emblems this morning. We can aspire to many things and in many different areas of life. The most obvious and prevalent is that of material gain. Coming up to the Christmas festival, this aspect of life for many around us is probably the most prominent. We are bombarded by advertising trying to divert our aspirations into buying whatever product will make the advertiser the most money and thus fulfill their own aspirations. We do not have to travel far before an advertising hoarding is trying to persuade us that our aspirations can be met by one product or another. Advertising is all pervasive in our modern society, and all of it is targeting our aspirations, trying to persuade us that our lives will be better if they conform to a particular model. But simple material gain is just one thing that we can aspire to. Anything we can aspire to do better or differently. Self-improvement is something we have all aimed at at some stage, whether this be through formal education as a child or young adult, or self-education or training in later life. We might aspire to learn a new language, to play an instrument, to lose weight, to gain weight, to become a better speaker, a better driver, a better cook, and so on. This list is limited only by our imagination. We can also have aspirations for others. Very typically, parents have aspirations for their children. This can be backed up by planning for the future we have envisaged for them. We might buy them some premium bonds to give them a nest egg for the future. We might put their names down for a school that we feel will give them the best chance of a good education. We might even move to a new area that we feel would give them greater opportunities. Very often, the achievement of ambition, the realizing of one's aspirations, is seen as a sign of virtue. The lives of the rich and famous are presented as something to which ordinary people should aspire, regardless of the actual moral character of the person themselves. The cult of celebrity that is such a feature of modern life is just one manifestation of this. When questioned recently, a group of primary school children revealed that many of them just wanted to be famous. Not for anything specific, just famous. Their aspiration was to seek celebrity purely for its own sake, rather than as a side effect of something more worthwhile. And this attitude is reinforced by the media, which idolizes celebrities without really questioning their worth. Turning our attention now from ourselves and the world around us, let's consider the primary subject of our first reading for today, the man Job. When we look at the early chapters of Job, we see someone who had achieved many of the things to which his peers would have aspired. He was wealthy, respected, and had a large and apparently healthy and prosperous family. There were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, and 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 she asses, and a very great household. so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the East. The respect he enjoyed from his contemporaries is described by Job later in the book. The young men saw me and hid themselves. The aged arose and stood up. The princes refrained talking and laid their hand on their mouth. The nobles held their peace and their tongue cleaved to the roof of their mouth. That's taken from Job chapter 29, verse 8. And then in verse 21, unto me men gave ear and waited and kept silence at my counsel. After my words they spake not again, and my speech dropped upon them. And they waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouth wide as for the latter rain. If I laughed on them, they believed it not, and the light of my countenance they cast not down. I chose out their way and sat chief, and dwelt as a king in the army, as one that comforteth the mourners. In contrast to many successful people in his and our times, Job was in no doubt that all his possessions and achievements were the result of God's blessings. In this 29th chapter, Job describes this time as the days when God preserved me, when his candle shined upon my head, and when by his light I walked through darkness. The secret of God was upon my tabernacle. The Almighty was yet with me. Job also had aspirations for his children, and I think we have an indication of these in the opening chapter. His sons went and feasted in their houses, every one his day, and sent and called for their three sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. Perhaps here we have a hint at Job's ambition for his children, that they would follow his example of godly behaviour, an aspiration that they perhaps were not yet living up to. He also had no doubt that these blessings would continue. His hopes for the immediate future were not dissimilar to those we might have. "Then I said, I shall die in my rest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. My root was spread out by the waters, and the dew lay all night upon my branch. My glory was fresh in me, and my bow was renewed in my hand." Job could look at his current situation, acknowledge that he was greatly blessed, consider that he was using these blessings to please God as far as he was able, and could see no reason why this should not continue into the future. His aspirations, as far as he could judge, were for a long, comfortable, and well-deserved future. Yet for all of us, our aspirations are simply models of what we would like our future to be. And there are many circumstances which can prevent us achieving the realization of this ideal. Indeed, there are times in our lives when we have no ambitions, no aspirations. The most obvious of these are at either end of our lives. We have no aspirations as a newborn, and none when we are about to die. Neither do we have aspirations when our circumstances are so extreme that they preclude any but the most basic consideration of the future. When we are extremely ill, for example, our focus is restricted greatly. Our aspirations may only extend into the next few minutes, because we cannot contemplate anything beyond the immediate future. In our current readings from Job, we see Job in these very circumstances. Everything that gave him hope for the future had been taken away from him. Everything to which he had aspired had been stripped away, and he was left utterly destitute. He summarizes the situation in these words: "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither." In the chapters we have read over the last couple of days, Job expands on the desolation of his current situation. Everything and everyone that he previously relied on had failed him. Just as the fulfillment of aspirations can be seen as evidence of virtue, so the failure of them can be interpreted as being due to moral failure. This is exactly the mistake that Job's three friends made. Today's chapter contains just one more example of the three friends of Job associating his experiences with the just reward of wickedness. "The increase of his house shall depart, and his goods shall flow away in the day of his wrath. This is the portion of a wicked man from God, and the heritage appointed unto him by God." But it appears they were not the only ones. During Job's distress, he appears to have experienced the general condemnation of those around him. "He has alienated my brothers from me. My acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My kinsmen have gone away. My friends have forgotten me. My guests and my maidservants count me as a stranger. They look upon me as an alien. I summon my servant, but he does not answer, though I beg him with my own mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife. I am loathsome even to my brothers. Even the little boys scorn me. When I appear, they ridicule me. All my intimate friends detest me. Those I love have turned against me. I am nothing but skin and bones. I have escaped with only the skin of my teeth." That's from Job 19 from the NIV. Just as his friends and acquaintances had deserted him, so also had Job's plans for the future. A couple of chapters earlier, we read these words: "My days have passed, my plans are shattered, and so are the desires of my heart." Yet Job is not held up to us as an example of hopeless misery, but rather as one of enduring under suffering, which is why he is such an example to us, to each of us here today, several thousand years after his death. A key factor behind this is to be found in this same chapter, because we find that Job was not in fact without hope, but his focus had changed. From having multiple plans, many desires of his heart, he was left with one unshakable conviction. From having many and various prospects for his future happiness, Job was left with just one. "If the only home I hope for is the grave, if I spread out my bed in darkness, if I say to corruption, 'You are my father,' and to the worm, 'My mother or my sister,' where then is my hope? Who can see any hope for me? Will it go down to the gates of death? Will we descend together into the dust? But no, a lonely grave was not the hope left for Job. He had confidence in something much more. Although he did not understand why God had chosen to test him as he had retained his confidence in God's ability to reward Job for his righteousness. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another. So Job's life at this point had been reduced to its absolute essentials. There are, in fact, only three things we need. Two of them are listed in this famous passage from 1 Timothy, mirroring some of Job's words we looked at earlier. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. And Job, in spite of his extreme suffering, was neither starving nor dying of exposure. So we can assume that his basic bodily needs of sustenance and protection from the elements were being met. The third thing, as we have just considered, is the hope of a Redeemer that Job retained, and that has been shared by God's servants throughout the ages. Part of the value of Job's example to us is that it illustrates just how little we actually need to please God. Job's fulfilling and varied life had been reduced to its absolute essentials, to a point far beyond anything that he or anyone would have considered reasonable. And yet he is commended by God for his actions during this time of trial. The final instructions to the three friends make this very clear. Go to my servant Job and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you. For him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, in that ye have not spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job. There is nothing inherently wrong with having more than the essentials, but it's helpful to keep them in context. They are blessings from God that make our lives now more pleasant than they strictly need to be, and that can allow us to be more profitable to Him. God knows that most of us, if tested like Job, would not come through the experience as well as he did. So we are protected most of the time from having to experience life stripped to its barest elements. So now we come to the focal point of our meeting this morning, to remember another man whose life was always focused on the absolute essentials. Unlike Job, though, Jesus voluntarily renounced all worldly ambitions and aspirations to dedicate himself to God's work. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. The material poverty of Jesus' life is expressed very clearly in these words to one who offered to follow him. Jesus said unto him, Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. Reflecting this attitude to worldly ambition is the Apostle John's advice that we read together this morning. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passeth away, and the lust thereof. But he that doeth the will of God abideth for ever. Jesus' aspirations, like our own, were actually on a far greater scale. By renouncing the short-term ambitions presented by the world around him, Jesus took on the far greater prospect offered by his Father. By focusing on the one needful thing, Jesus achieved everything. Let's finish the passage we looked at earlier from the Philippians. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him, and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of things in heaven and things in earth, and things under the earth. And that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. In a few minutes, we will take the bread and the wine to remind us of Jesus' sacrifice for us. As we remember his sufferings on the cross, we see him voluntarily giving up everything except his hope. As we remember his resurrection, we see him receiving far more from his Father than could ever be offered by the world around us. Let us also refresh our aspiration to share those glories with him.
Our memorial hymn, we will sing hymn 79. Sing praise, the tomb is void, where the Redeemer lay. Sing of our bonds destroyed, our darkness turned to day. Weep for your dead no more, friends, be of joyful cheer. Our star moves on before, our narrow path shines clear. Hymn 79. Concluding hymn 93, after which would Brother Chris please close with prayer. Hymn 93, look ye saints, the sight is glorious. See the man of sorrows now, to the earth returned victorious. To every knee to him shall bow. Crown him, crowns become the victor's brow. Hymn 93.